Hello, and welcome back to Fan Critical. It is a girls-only podcast today. I'm Emma, your host, and I'm joined again by the recently resurfaced Lucy.
Yes, I'm back at the surface level.
She's back in town. Yep. We are covering today a podcast that's been commissioned for us by one of our patrons, Beth Panico, on the 2018 neo-noir film by Drew Goddard, Bad Times at the El Royale.
Do you like the term neo-noir? It sounds like something you say when you're trying to exercise your mouth. Neo-noir, neo-noir.
Neo-noir. I didn't coin that. I stole that. I'll be honest.
No, I gathered that. But you know, it's just a good word to throw around.
So I was quite interested when Beth said, can we cover this? So Beth has been a fan of ours for a long time. She's supported us for ages, yeah. And she's great. And she's come up with some really interesting films for us to cover.
She has. She's a patron, isn't she? And that's how she gets, this is how she commissions these things. She's a top tier patron. So hello, Beth.
Yes, elite blueberry Beth.
And thank you for your continued support.
Absolutely. And we'll tell you a little bit more about how you can get involved in that in a little while. But I hadn't heard of this film, actually. And so when we spoke about doing it, I looked it up and I thought, yeah, sounds all right. Good cast. I mean, I got as far as Chris Hemsworth and I was sold.
Chris Hemsworth,
basically.
Got an unbuttoned shirt, you say. Okay, yes, I'll watch this film. I mean, I actually saw a trailer for this at the cinema, like however long ago, a couple of years, I suppose now. And I did want to see it, but then it seemed to just sink without a trace. Like, I never heard anything about it, good or bad. It just sort of... And considering the cast, I was quite surprised. It's a bit of a weird one in that respect, that it just it was never really on anyone's radar that I was aware of.
No, I totally agree. And actually, when I did some research for this after I'd watched the film, there's not really a huge amount about it out there. There's a couple of mixed reviews, but it did just sort of drop off the radar, so it's quite nice to be able to sit down and watch it and see what we think. Before I ask you for your opinion, Lucy, I'm gonna give you the IMDb summary of this film.
Shoot.
So it goes: early 1970s, four strangers check in at the El Royale Hotel. The hotel is deserted, staffed by
1970s though, because it says it's 1969. So
no, I don't think it is. Incorrect, IMDb.
Yeah, I'm going to take umbrage with that straight away, IMDb, because you're not accurate.
Yep.
Watch the film next time.
Incorrect.
Pay attention. Sorry,
I bet
on.
You haven't even seen it, IMDb. The hotel is deserted, staffed by a single desk clerk. Some of the new guests' reasons for being there are less than innocent, and some are not who they appear to be. Which doesn't give a lot away, and it is incorrect, because it is 1969.
It's not the early 70s.
I'm pretty sure that somewhere I read that someone had worked out the exact date it was based on some of the news coverage of Nixon. I think it's like the 27th of March 1969 or something.
There you go. Interesting, that.
So, interesting. When I first read that, it just made me think of the Eagles' song, Hotel California.
Yeah. You can check out any time you like, but you can never leave. That'll be important later. Remember that.
It will indeed. But Lucy, you've just recently watched this as well. Can you give me an overview of what you thought and your blueberries and an explanation of what that system is, please?
Okay. Like I say, when I first heard of this film a couple of years ago, I did want to see it, but it did just kind of drop off my radar. It's got a really strong cast and I thought it was really well shot, but I didn't think it was executed that well. I feel like I've seen this film before. I've seen films of similar nature, whether that be like Agatha Christie. I mean, I read somewhere that it's like Agatha Christie meets Quentin Tarantino, which I think is quite accurate, but it doesn't come off as well as it should, considering those are the influences. I hate the title. I just could go on and on about this, but I said this to you yesterday, didn't I? I just think it's the most cumbersome, vague, clunky title and so forgettable. And I think that might have something to do with why it just fell off the radar, because just Bad Times at the El Royale, like when you actually watch it, Bad Times is such an understatement. It's just, I don't know, it loses a blueberry for me for that. I hate the title.
I mean, it could be like, you know, it's the understatement of the century, isn't it? Without giving
it
too much away.
It's quite flippant as well. Bad Times,
fucking nightmare at the El Royale.
Yeah, bloodbath, if anything. So I would give it, I thought about this yesterday, I'll give it 3 blueberries. Now, for those who are new to the podcast, welcome. Blueberries is the scale with which we rate what we're reviewing. So 5 blueberries would be the best. zero blueberries would be the worst, and you cannot halve a blueberry, so you have to give a round score. So yeah, I would give it 3 blueberries because I think some of the sort of direction and the shots was really, really good, really interesting, the way some of it was done, stuff that you've never really seen before, which we'll get on to. Acting was good for the most part, and it looked good. It's just the execution for me. I don't think the revelations of what was really going on was done particularly well. And that fucking title, I think it's terrible. So yeah, 3 blueberries for me.
I mean, to be fair, that's not a bad score.
It's
3
not,
is like, it's above average.
It wasn't bad. I just didn't think it was that good. It was quite uneven, I thought. Especially the last third. When...
Yeah, it got a bit hectic.
Yeah, when Hemsworth turned up. You know, that should improve any film, but it actually made it go take a bit of a swerve that sort of didn't really fit with what had come before. And it was quite a long film, but I also felt it was paced strangely.
Yeah, I think, so we talk a lot about pacing, usually with TV shows, like films, not so much. And I think, like, the pacing in this is interesting, and I feel like it's quite deliberate. I really enjoyed this.
Oh, wow.
I haven't sat down and watched a film that I've not paused to go off and do some washing up or something in months. And yeah, I mean, I know we're all living in a weird world, but I really, really enjoyed it. I thought it was humorous at times. I thought, stylistically, it was really interesting.
Yeah,
so,
it looked great.
You know, yeah, it looked fantastic. You've got all of those, like... kind of placard black scenes which remind you very much like silent movies, you know, an old noir cinema, that kind of thing. It's got an amazing cast.
Cast was great.
Like, blew me away. Some of the acting was unbelievable, I thought, and some surprising performances in there. The soundtrack was fantastic. I enjoyed some of the twists and like the references. I have to say, and like some of this comes up a little bit later, I think it reminded me a lot of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
See, I have not seen that, so it is Tarantino-esque. I thought, like, Hateful Eight, it reminded me of just the concept.
I haven't seen the Hateful Eight either, so like probably between us, it's so
we've got it right.
I wonder if it's, you know, you said about that Agatha Christie Tarantino thing, and it is. It's kind of like the locked room. Kind of mystery type thing. You know, everyone's all in one place, and you expect Miss Marple to turn up and tell you what's happened.
People are not what they see.
Yeah.
But I did think the kind of revelation of what the truth was. I feel like I've seen it done better in things like Agatha Christie than there was none. There was.
I mean, she is the master.
She is. But just to put it on screen, it also reminded me a bit, for some reason, of Knives Out. I don't know if you've seen that. Which is really good.
No, I haven't yet, but it's on my list to watch. I'm actually going to watch it tonight.
I think it's just mysteries, but the way certain things are revealed in that film, I think was done a lot better than this. I don't know. I think I wanted to like it probably a bit more than I actually did. Then some of it was just a bit uneven with regards to tone. But what I will say, actually, is that it was not predictable, because there were a few things that happened. I was like, oh, didn't see that coming. It does have that. It had that, the element of surprise in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and I thought, like, it's quite interesting because Drew Goddard has done lots of different stuff, but one of the things that I've seen recently that's on is he's an executive producer on The Good Place, which is really interesting.
Really?
When we talk about some of the themes in this. Yeah, and I didn't realise that, but actually knowing that in hindsight, you can tell, and that's quite, I thought that was quite interesting. I mean, for me, like, I enjoyed it. I watched the whole thing through. I was gripped. I was surprised. Yeah, okay, maybe it was a bit too long, but you know me, I'm like, solid 90 minutes.
Yeah,
that's enough.
No, that
I know you agree.
Law. Yeah,
it should definitely be the law. But combining like all of the storylines and the character performances and, you know, the other performances across the way, I give this a 4 blueberry.
Oh wow! Well, yeah. I mean, I think, yeah. I don't think that's completely outlandish. It just, I don't think it landed for me the way I wanted it to, and I feel like I've seen other films that have done it better. But it was, there were interesting, it was worth watching, and there were interesting themes and some great performances, like you say.
Definitely. Well, I think what we're going to do today, because our commission podcasts are always a little bit different. So we're going to talk a little bit about the cast, because I think that's really important.
Mm-hmm.
Have a little run through the basic outlining of the plot. Then I've got some references and trivia for us.
Lovely.
And then we get to talk about our favourite scenes before we round up with some kind of final thoughts. But before we do that, I'm going to have just a little advert break.
First time at the El Royale?
You have the option to stay in either California or Nevada.
I always want to stay in the honeymoon suite, even though I'm not currently on my honeymoon.
It's that time of the podcast where I nag at you about all our other content. I know we're very early in, and this might be your first foray into Fan Critical, but I hope it's not. Fan Critical is our parent podcast, and at the moment, as things are a little uncertain in the arts and media's world, we've been doing some different things. So you might have caught some of our How the Fuck Have You Not Seen That series, where we are all bringing out the films from our closet that we've pretended to see for years that none of us actually have. So most recently was Lucy's Closet of Shame, and she revealed to us all that she had not ever seen Aliens. Yeah. It is a fantastic podcast, really good laugh, And what did you think of Aliens, Lucy? Did you like it?
Yeah, 5 bloobs from me, Em.
See, there you go. It's hilarious. I listened to it while I was doing the gardening the other week and absolutely cracked up. We've also been doing quite a lot of commission podcasts lately. So Len and Gareth have recently done A Clockwork Orange, which is a very interesting topic or kind of plot and style to cover. We just released Midsummer, which was a great hit last year, and I think like Gaz's favourite film of 2019 or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, he loves it, and I think Len loves it as well. Listen to the podcast.
Yeah, Len loves everything.
I haven't seen the film because I'm a wimp, so I haven't listened to it yet, but
yeah, same.
I'm sure it's great.
And also, the guys are going to be joining up with one of our little brother podcasts, literally, Story Mode, who are a video game podcast, and they're going to be doing a Last of Us 2 spoiler cast episode in the coming weeks, so that will definitely be good fun to listen to if that is your jam. Not only that, we've got some really exciting stuff coming up. So we've got new Worst of Netflix, where John and Gareth delve through the pits of Netflix to find the worst rated films, watch them, and review them so that you don't have to. Even more exciting, we have actually got some new TV series coverage coming up soon, even if we are in a bit of a coronavirus drought. In August, Lovecraft Country is coming out, so we will be doing a preview podcast on that in the coming weeks and covering the series when it is released. So if you like the stuff that we do, or if you want to commission a podcast like Beth has done here, then you can support us on Patreon. Lucy, tell us a bit about that.
So Patreon, you have different tiers, and depending on how much you contribute each month, you get different benefits. So if you are a junior blueberry, $5 a month, you get to join in on Discord. You can chat to us about whatever you want to chat to us about, but mainly TV,
anything.
TV and
TV
films.
Film.
People usually stick to that. And you get access to Cast It. So Cast It episodes are bonus episodes that we do where we would take a film or TV show, usually a film, and we recast it. It usually turns out quite funny. Sometimes you improve on the original casting, I find.
Agreed.
And you can go from that level all the way up to, as Beth has done today, you can commission your own podcast, and when coronavirus finally subsides, you'll be able to potentially appear on a podcast of your choosing also. So yeah, definitely.
Indeed.
If you're interested in supporting us, if you like what we do, if you head over to patreon.com/fancritical and you can check out how you can contribute and what awards you'll get. Rewards you'll get, not awards.
You can have awards too if you like.
For the best
we'll
Patreon,
give you a
yeah.
Patreon gold star.
Yes.
Thank you, Lucy. Yeah, absolutely. Keep in touch with us on social media as well. We are at FanCriticalPod on Twitter, Fan_Critical on Instagram, and just FanCritical on Facebook. Or you can email us, FanCriticalPodcast@gmail.com. But for now, it's time to get back to Bad Times at the El Royale.
So bad.
Just too good to be true. So I want to talk about the cast, because I think we've got an amazing cast here, really. There's a really interesting mix of actors and characters. So I'm going to list our main team off, and then we'll pick and choose, have a conversation about some of them. So we've got Jeff Bridges starring as Father Daniel Flynn, or Doc O'Kelly.
Excellent.
Cynthia Erivo as Darlene Sweet.
Brilliant. And I like that she got to sing.
Oh, amazing. Dakota Johnson plays Emily Summerspring,
really,
which was interesting.
Her hair.
Haven't seen
really
her for
liked her hair.
Oh, and those jeans, man.
Makes me want a fringe, but I've got a fat face, so it doesn't ever look good. But, you know, Just hair inspo there from Dakota.
I can't wear a fringe. I've got a small forehead.
I
got a three
that
head.
Sort of hair would look good on you. Because it wasn't a full fringe. It was kind of like parting fringe.
Oh, maybe. We'll see. Then we've got the lovely John Hamm, starring as Laramie Seymour Sullivan, or his real name, FBI agent Dwight Broadbeck.
Always called Dwight.
Oh, it's always a Dwight, isn't there? Kaylee Spaney as Emily's sister Rose.
Creepy.
Lewis Pullman as Miles Miller. And then, of course, Chris Hemsworth as Billy Lee.
You ugly son of a bitch.
Oh, man. Right, let's talk about Cynthia Erivo. Like, yes. She is amazing.
Yeah, she's a fantastic actress and singer.
Yeah, amazing. Absolutely amazing singer. And I had no idea. Her voice is stunning.
Yeah.
And her performance, I thought, was amazing. So Darlene Sweet is a backing singer, as we learn from her background. But she's also doing a few kind of small performances on her own. She's had probably not some not great experiences in the past, being a woman of colour in the 60s.
In America, yeah.
In America, yeah.
In the music industry.
But what I really liked about the way that she played the character was her almost like smooth detachedness.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
There's a real clarity to her performances. She's just,
it's
like pinpoint accuracy with her performances. And yeah, I think she always seems in control even when she's not. Like, as in, when the character's
totally
not, but she's very composed, in control of herself.
And I think also she portrayed quite a lot of depth here. So you've got the kind of the Darlene Sweet when she's outside of her own private space, and she's very almost kind of almost meek, but not. She's just very composed.
She's watching. Like, she's, you can see and you can kind of tell, like, as you said, like a woman of colour in the 60s in America, in the industry that she's in, she's always going to have to be like watchful, on the lookout for anything and everything that could befall her, and that obviously stands her in good stead for what's to come at the El Royale, because she's aware of everything that's around her. She's very watchful.
And I think the other thing is kind of the contrast of that when she's on her own in private, the emotion and the kind of rawness to her.
Yeah.
As, like when you first see her singing, it's just beautiful.
And there's joy. There's such a joy to it. It's not...
Yeah.
You know, she's singing and she loves it. And yet, like you say, in her private space, that's when she can be herself. And she completely opens up, because she's quite closed when she's with other people. For good reason, because she has to be on guard.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think for me, she's like the standout performance of this.
I think she roots the entire film, and she's the emotional like core of it. And without her, it wouldn't stand, I don't think. And she's now an actress that if I know she's in a film, I will think, oh, I want to see that, because I just think she was so good in The Outsider, which we covered. She was the high point of that. And she's the high point of this film as well. So she's just fantastic.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think, what a lovely segue that's about to come here. Her relationship with Father Daniel Flynn, played by Jeff Bridges, is really, really good. Because, you know, you talk about that awareness that she has in other people. Obviously, we know later on that Jeff Bridges' character is not a priest.
Shock horror.
He's a criminal. Which is, you know... 60s America. Why not rob some trucks full of money? Don't do it now, you know, but...
Well, 50s America, I believe it actually happened in. I don't know why I'm being such a stickler for the dates, so just ignore me, but yeah.
You are really, really on the dates today,
Lewis.
Have
a good date.
I hadn't realised that Jeff Bridges was in it, so when he popped up, I was like, oh, it's Jeff Bridges.
It's funny, because Aaron came in while I was watching it, and he didn't say anything. He was just like, is that Kurt Russell? I was like, no, it's Jeff Bridges. They look quite similar, but no. It's not Kurt Russell.
I mean, somewhat similar. Not quite.
But like,
it's Jeff Bridges,
for God's
sake.
Vibes, I think.
Yeah.
I got what he was saying, but he's great, Jeff Bridges.
Yeah, and I think his character is really interesting, because there's a lot throughout this film about the idea of redemption, in a way.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, a combination of redemption, confession, absolution, that kind of thing. So obviously his disguise as a priest is very apt for that, and you know, it's a theme that we'll probably pick up on again. But I thought that, I mean, obviously Jeff Bridges is an amazing actor, but I thought he played it really well, because you really started to, I mean, I don't know about you, but I really started to feel for him, and I was rooting for him. I wanted him to find that money that his brother had buried under the floorboards, and you know, I was worried about the fact that, spoiler warning for the rest of the plot, I hope you've all watched this, that he has dementia, which is really sad.
Yeah.
And I think he was quite an interesting linchpin for the, you know, he, again, you know, as you said, it kind of hinges on Cynthia Erivo's character, but actually Father Flynn is the second hinge for the film. You know, without that storyline, you think you don't really get much of the rest.
No, but I did think the fact that he kind of, I didn't trust what he was saying to begin with. Obviously, you know, he's not a priest. But when he was telling Cynthia Erivo, I did think, is he going to turn around again and sort of double cross her? And he didn't. And I kind of, I think it might have had a bit more impact if it wasn't kind of a happy ending for the two of them. But I suppose it adds balance to the film. You don't want everyone to be dead. Then it really would be a Tarantino film.
And also, you know, it's not exactly a happy ending, is it? They went through some pretty shitty stuff.
Yeah, it's quite bad, yeah.
So then we've got Dakota Johnson and Kaylee Spaney as the Summer Spring sisters. I've not really seen Dakota Johnson in much. Have you?
I think I've only seen her in 21 Jump Street, my favourite film, and she's not really in that much. but she is an interesting actress, I think, just watching her in this. Because she was in 50 Shades of Grey, which I have not seen. Something like that could have derailed her career, really, because it was a bit, as far as I'm aware, it was a bit of a bomb. Or she could have gone the way of just doing equally shitty films. But I know she's done this film. I think she did a remake of Suspiria. Like, she's doing a bit more interesting work. Nothing will ever top 21
Jump
Street.
Yeah, she's branching out quite a bit.
That's the best film ever.
Obviously.
But yeah, I think I liked her in this. She was tough and it was believable. Because I don't always believe in these, like, having to represent women as being kick-ass, emotionally unavailable superhumans. Because I just think, you know, don't patronise women like that. But this was...
Well, it's a trope, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a trope and I have no interest in it. But you could see kind of behind her eyes what had led her to this point. And yeah, I thought it was a good performance. Really nice hair. And that whole look for her, it really works. 70s, well, late 60s, sorry, look. Looked very good on her.
Yeah, come on, get the dates right, Liz. I mean, and that's actually one of the things that I really like about this film is the kind of the setting and the styling of that. So then you've got John Hamm as Laramie Seymour Sullivan, who we later find out is actually an FBI agent.
Because his accent, I was like, this is pretty shocking. I don't think I can watch a whole film with him putting on a terrible foghorn, leghorn accent. But yeah, obviously that was part of it, that it was not his real accent.
But I think when he first appears and he's like, he's doing this whole like vacuum cleaner salesman thing, it was so like camp.
Yeah, it's almost. OTT, proper OTT.
Yeah, I loved it. I thought he was brilliant. I really liked it. And then you see him develop as he sort of lets more of his actual character come through, you know, the FBI agent, and you see his fear.
I would have liked to have more of that, to be honest with you. And I think that's one thing when I talk about the pacing, is that you get a little peek into his home life. You know, he's calling his daughter to say their nightly prayers. He wants to help Rose that he sees kidnapped. And the fact that you kind of got that little peek into his humanity and his character, because he's hardly developed at all before he, spoiler warning, gets shot or sawn in half almost with a shotgun. I just think that...
Yeah, it was rough.
I would have liked more... Considering he's like one of the bigger names in it, I would have liked more of his character developed in order for that to have more impact, what happens to him and the fact that he wanted to help. I don't know. I thought that was a bit like, oh, he's gone.
Yeah, it was just a bit of a shame that we didn't get more of him.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that was a bit of a letdown for me, that part.
Yeah, and I think some of that comes with the pacing as well, is that there's a bit kind of halfway through where things really speed up and a load of shit happens, and I think that's when we lose John Hamm.
Yeah.
And that, I think,
yeah.
It was a bit of a shock to me, because I assumed he'd be in the whole thing.
Revelation, revelation, and that's what I thought would be the pacing and the revelations of the truth, was it wasn't done as well as it could have been. It wasn't executed that well.
What I do think was executed... What I do think was executed very well was Lewis Pullman's performance as Miles Miller.
So does he... Sorry to interrupt you. I was watching it and he just reminded me so much of a less sort of appealing-looking Tom Holland. I just really thought he looked
like
him.
Well, that's interesting. Because I'm pretty sure that Tom Holland was asked to play one of the roles and it may well have been that. And
really?
He said no.
Wow. I think he might have been a bit young, because I'm not sure how old Miles was supposed to be. But when they showed, you know, you show the flashback at the end that showed that he was, I presume, in Vietnam.
Yep.
That he, yeah, he's sort of old enough to go and fight in a war and to be the manager of a hotel. So I think Tom Holland probably would have been a bit too baby-faced. But he did remind me of him, but he just, his face isn't as appealing at all. And that he really lent quite a creepy quality to Miles, where you think, what is, what's his deal? And he's like, about the terrible things he's done.
Originally, I was like, is this some kind of like psycho character murder hotel thing? And there's a hotel somewhere in America. It's probably more of these, but it's a bit like the H.H. Holmes hotel thing, you know, where like people were trapped in rooms and murdered in the basement and all of those kind of things. And I thought it was going to go that way. So when it didn't, it was quite interesting. But I thought that his characterization was amazing because he was really fucking creepy. But you also, I think, had a lot of sympathy for him by the end.
Yeah, it was...
So I think
was,
that's a really good character arc.
Yeah, it was an interesting performance because, yeah, he did give you the creeps and there was kind of an element of disgust that you had for him, just like he was such a loser. I know that sounds horrible, but a loser and creepy and couldn't stand up for himself. So there is an element of, like, yeah, disgust for him. But then by the end, you do feel some pity for him. And it was interesting, like, his quote-unquote revelation of his backstory and what he considered to have been the evil that he's done. I mean, you could say that was a commentary on America at the time. I mean, yeah. I don't know if, I suppose we can talk about it, or I don't know if you want to talk about it later, like his, when he said how many people he killed and what that actually means. Made me think.
I think it's worth talking about that. Well, I think maybe save the full commentary for it for plot, because I think it kind of ties very much into once we know about everybody else. And then finally, I've saved the best for last. I've saved the best for last. Chris Hemsworth as Billy Lee. And I say the best because he's beautiful and we love Chris Hemsworth.
We do.
I don't know how I felt about him in this film, though.
No, neither did I. It felt like he was shoehorned from a different film.
Yeah, like a little bit kind of like crackhead, bonkers, but also like hippie.
So I've gone on about the period. But yeah, so it's this late of 60s going on into the 70s and it's a completely different look. It's just a completely different lifestyle that he's living anyway. And I think that could be part of it. But I was worried at first that he was meant to represent or actually be Charles Manson. I was like, that is the most fucking flattering casting of all time, if that's the case. But obviously,
well,
not.
He's clearly based on Manson.
But I thought it was going to be like, oh, this is Charles Manson. And then that would be really bad.
Oh, yeah. One of the interesting things about it is that there are a few things where you can clearly go, oh, well, that's meant to be so-and-so. But because they don't name any of them, you remain in this fantasy world where, you know, it isn't Charles Manson and JFK. It's
I knew it was JFK.
Billy Lee and an unknown. Yeah, I mean, obviously it's JFK, right? So, you know, I thought that was quite interesting. And I don't think I've seen him play a role like that before. It looked like he had quite a lot of fun with it.
Definitely.
But he was clearly, you know, playing quite unhinged.
I mean, just to sort of riff on Chris Hemsworth for a bit, obviously we love him and, you know, he looks the way he looks and that's great. But I'm worried for him that his looks are going to hinder his career, which is a bizarre thing to say, but I worry that he's just going to go down the action man route, because I've seen him as Thor and he's absolutely great as Thor. I think he's probably the standout in these Avenger films because he just imbues this larger than life character with such humor and goofiness and silliness, which, you know, you don't always
it's
see
the comedy,
in a superhero.
Isn't it?
But I just don't want him to go down just being an action man, because I think he's got so much charisma and, yeah, there's such humour to him, which is a bit unfair considering how he looks. Like, you want to be funny as well. Give the other humans a chance.
Yeah, come on. Allow us some of that.
Yeah, but the most recent film he's been in, I didn't watch it because it's not my kind of film, but it was on Netflix, like an action, I think it's called Extraction film.
It is.
Yeah, and I just don't want him to go down that road. I really want him to do more films like this. Like, as much as it's not a perfect film or performance, I hope he can take risks and he's not just going to be cast as like the buff action man in meaningless, forgettable films. I just think he's actually worth more than that. And it would be a shame if just the way he looks stops him from making better films. Do you know what I mean?
Well, you don't want him to be pigeonholed, do you?
No.
Like, you want him to be able to go and do something a bit indie and a bit weird like this.
And I hope he does.
Not indie, but you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
But it reminds me a lot of Brad Pitt. So, like, you always think of Brad Pitt as the pretty guy, right?
Mm.
You know, everybody loves Brad Pitt, and especially, like, thinking about the 90s. And the one thing that made me change my opinion about Brad Pitt was seeing him in Burn after reading.
I have not seen that. I'm not really a Brad Pitt fan, to be honest. But, yes, I understand what you mean. It's a good comparison.
He's hilarious, and I never realised he was funny. And I think for me, watching Chris Hemsworth in this reminded me, not because he's not playing a funny character, it's funny at all.
But there is humour to the performance.
Yeah, it reminded me of that, which is, it's something I've never seen him do before, and it's something different, and I liked it, even if it felt a bit weird.
Yeah, I just think it didn't fit in with the tone of the film. And again, I think they put him in too late for you to really have any kind of, oh, this guy's a dick, or to have any kind of feelings about him. So I just, that's what the problem with the film is. There's not enough, there's almost too many characters to make you care about any of them, apart from probably Darlene.
Yeah, I think you might be right. Well, I think that's a good point, actually, to kind of bring us onto the plot is, you know, where we start getting interested in people and, you know, how much we learn about them. So I think that let's talk through it. I've got a summary. I'm not going to do too much detail
because,
you know, I want you guys to watch this film. It's a long film. But I think let's talk about the opening. So there's no opening credits, really. We open in 1959 where a man is hiding a bag of money under floorboards in a hotel room. Another bloke arrives and it's very like film noir setting, kills him with a shotgun and then walks off. And then I think we get the flash of 10 years later and the title screen, and that's it. That is how we open this film. And I was like, this is not what I was expecting.
Yeah, it was definitely a good opening, and it kind of looped back to that, but it's almost like the you know, in Psycho when the main character has like stolen some money or whatever, and you think that that's going to be what the film's about, and then it totally is not about that at all. And this, it was about the money, but it also isn't really about the money, this film. And
yeah, the money was kind of the undercurrent, wasn't it?
But it's not what draws everyone there. It's Nick Offerman, isn't it?
Is it?
Yeah, because his name was in the cast, and I recognised just his square silhouette head. So I would have liked to see a bit more of him. I thought he might pop up in a flashback, but it doesn't really, does he? I think he's there in his mask.
No,
in the flashback to the robbery.
I think that's pretty much it. Yeah, but I think that opened us up quite nicely to like how they frame the film. Like,
it's shot really well
and it's consistent, which I like. So, you know, every character gets their bit, you know, whether it's room one, room four, room five, or it's, you know, the backstory of Billy Lee, or, you know, all of those things. And I think that really helps. But once we've had this kind of first scene, we get our, you know, 10 years later flash up. John would hate this. He hates being told how much time has passed on the screen. And we're in the lobby of the El Royale Hotel, and, you know, various different interactions are happening between Daniel Flynn, the priest, Father Flynn, Darlene Sweet, Laramie Seymour Sullivan, and Emily Summerspring eventually arrives. What I liked most about this beginning was not kind of necessarily learning about the characters, but the really interesting setup of the hotel. So it is basically slap bang across the line, the state line between California and Nevada, which is so odd.
More films should be set across like state lines like that. I mean, I'm sure there are listeners, if you know of any that we should watch, let us know. But it's definitely an interesting conceit, and I liked how the keys had the state shaped key rings. I thought that was a nice touch.
Yeah. Well, and it's also like the difference between California, which is like your sun-loving hippies, and Nevada, which is your gamblers and your casinos. And I think having that all in one place is really interesting. And the way that we get that introduction from Miles, who is not there initially. He appears to be the only person left working in this hotel. He is the receptionist, he is the barman, he is the chef, he is the housekeeper, which is all very odd and does give you kind of very strange H.H. Holmes gonna get murdered vibe.
Weird vibe. It's also weird how they all turned up there, and they're not linked. They're not really linked at all. But yeah, they suddenly all turn up at the same place that's been abandoned for however long.
You mentioned this earlier that you've seen the new adaptation of And Then There Were None, this felt like that, where everybody gets a letter and they turn up at the same place. And I thought that the twist along the way was going to be that they'd all been invited there for a reason. Yeah.
Or there was some link between them. But yeah, no.
Yeah, that there was something that tied them all together. But that is not the case. So we won't delve down that road too deeply. So then everybody checks into their rooms. Everyone's just really keen to just get in and get done. No one wants to really be next to each other, and they all find it very awkward. Emily is a bit of a dick. She signs the register. Fuck you. She's clearly very keen to just get away from everyone. But we start really with Sullivan. So John Hamm's character. So he checks into the honeymoon suite, and then he starts removing wiretaps.
Yeah.
So he's basically disrupted the entire room into like absolute disarray, pulling out these wiretaps and various different things. And then he seems, what he finds, basically two different sets of them, which at the time didn't really make sense until we get a bit later on. And then he goes nosing around in the hotel and finds a secret corridor. This happened quickly.
Yes.
And this is where it kind of went off track.
Yes.
In a good way.
Well, I think I just found the way it was paced, I thought it was a bit disjointed. I don't know. Like, it happened quickly, fine. Like, get into the meat of the story. I'm a fan of that. But, yeah, it all just unravelled from there, like, plot-wise, I guess, which is probably what it was supposed to do. But I just felt like, I don't know, we weren't grounded in it enough for it to just suddenly spring off like that. But that's just me, I guess.
I think that's probably why this has had quite mixed reactions as well, and kind of fallen by the wayside, I think, for a lot of people, because I really liked it. I liked the fact that all of a sudden it was like a snowball rolling downhill that kept gathering speed and gathering size, and didn't really know what was going to happen next. And I like that. You know, he goes down this back corridor while Miles is passed out from a heroin shot.
Yeah.
I don't know how you describe it. And he finds this corridor where all of the mirrors are basically one-way mirrors. They're observation mirrors, and there's a movie camera, and then he sees all of these things. And that, for me, was like, this is brilliant. Yeah. That kind of
that
voyeuristic
shot was great. It was supremely creepy. Ugh. It did give me very, like, bad vibes, bad feelings,
proper chills,
because you don't know. And there's always also the way a lot of the shots were framed, like, I'd say a close-up on John Hamm, or like semi-close-up, and then you can see what's sort of in the background, and you keep thinking you're going to see a man, or I don't know, a zombie or something. It was really
like a load of dead bodies or something. Yeah. Like, it's just,
it was really well done. Like, the suspense that it built at times was really, really well done. But it didn't have enough of that, almost, or it didn't compound that enough for it to be really cohesive for me, anyway. But yeah, that scene when he's walking along and turning the speakers on and just discovering the extent of what was happening there. Yeah, and you don't know what you're going to see, do you? It was quite creepy.
No, and like, when Miles had said earlier that some of the rooms weren't cleaned, I was like, what is in those rooms?
Yeah,
is it
going to
be
there?
A, here's my mother in a chair kind of thing?
style again.
But actually, yeah, exactly. Well, it felt like that. It really did. And actually, there are parts of this that go the complete opposite way, and it feels like a bit of a romp. And we'll talk about some of those bits. But what he actually sees is what he thinks is Emily with a kidnapped woman.
Yeah.
And I think he also sees Darlene Sweet singing, and Father Flynn sitting in his room looking very confused.
Yeah.
So he kind of dashes out of there and goes to the phone booth and makes a call into the FBI, where we're like, oh, wait a minute, you're an FBI agent, Dwight Broadbeck.
I mean, the bug removing does kind of give you some insight into what his real game is. Well, it did for me anyway.
And he's basically told to ignore the fact that he thinks he's seen a kidnapping.
So I not hate the FBI. Sorry if there are any FBI agents listening, but I hate in this respect.
Maybe they're not allowed to get involved.
Yeah, obviously, but okay, they just don't care then. They just don't care about... You could say, right, we'll call the police. Like, you could do anything, or like, we'll let the police know. Nah, just ignore it.
Also, he could have called the police.
Well, yeah, well, the FBI could have done it on his behalf. Just sent a car around.
Mind you, that'd be a terrible plot, wouldn't it?
Yes.
The police all turned up and nothing happened.
Everything was fine in the end. Everyone was safe.
So I want, let's talk about this kidnapping thing. So we see Emily getting a girl in from the boot of the car who's she then ties to a chair. She's got her gagged. We don't really know what's going on. What did you think was happening at that point before we knew who that was?
I thought we could have a potential ransom situation. She's kidnapped someone, a woman, kidnapping another woman. I just thought maybe that she was trying to get some, extort some money out of someone. Considering this all seemed to be about money. Yeah, that was kind of what my first notion was. What about you?
I wasn't quite sure. Yeah, I wasn't quite sure what was going on, because one of the things that I noticed when they were in the lobby, when John Hamm was doing his bit about making coffee and talking about vacuum cleaners like a knob, when Emily arrived, there was a news report about some murders in a house.
Yeah, actually.
And I thought maybe she was involved in that.
Yeah, now, there was something about like a respected doctor or someone who'd worked with homeless children in the area.
Public figure, some kind
of
public figure, yeah.
That sounds a bit, working with homeless children, like, is that going to come out to be something? Now, this whole bit kind of reminded me of this film I saw. I think I was on like a night bus in South America. Clang. I've had an interesting life, yes, listeners. But they put on like films. And there was one I watched, and it had Michael Madsen in it, who's just like, you know, if you see him, that's short.
Blimey, yeah.
That is shorthand for creepy, sinister. I can't remember what it was called. I think it's called, like, The Killing Jar or something. And there's, like, a massive storm, and people are in a cafe, and they, you know, it's on the news that this family have been murdered, brutally murdered, in town. Police are looking for the suspect. And Michael Madsen arrives in the cafe, and it's got that same sense of tension and, you know, what is the truth behind this scenario? And I actually think that it was quite violent and there were children on the bus. But anyway, it had that same sense of there's something on the news.
Not appropriate.
This, someone's just turned up, like, what is the truth? But this, it was a bit of a red herring, really, in this film, wasn't it? Because I don't believe it was linked to anything. Or was it? Have I missed something?
It was. It was, right at the end, I'll tell you, don't worry.
Oh, is it to do with thingy?
Yeah, so Emily's little sister, Rose... Yeah. Is clearly a fucking psychopath. She killed those people.
Why?
Yeah. So we get a bit of a flashback to her stabbing violently.
I thought that was her killing her dad. Well, actually, I thought Emily might have killed her dad, abusive dad.
I'm pretty sure Emily did kill her dad, but I'm pretty sure Rose killed those people. And that's what you said. There's a bit where, right at the end, where Billy Lee and Emily are talking, and one of them says something about, you know, we can forget about things that have been done or something like that. And I'm pretty sure that's what they're referring to, is Rose killing her family. And I've
no
idea why.
Until you, and he's like, really? Okay, interesting. So I've obviously missed that plot point. But I do think I do like it when that kind of thing, that thing happens, like, in the background. There's like a news report. It is a bit of a trope, but I think it works quite well.
Yeah, I think so. And I think for this, I think it was good because actually, you know, it's something that I was really aware of and, you know, picked up on. So once we've seen this, we then move on to Father Flynn and Darlene Sweet. So they eventually, they go and try and eat some dinner, but there's some really dodgy looking sandwiches or pie. So they go for some pie and they have a drink. And Darlene sees the father spiking her drink. So all of a sudden, she knocks the fucker out.
Good.
I mean, that was amazing. I was not expecting that to happen,
no.
But it was fantastic, and I thought that was really, really interesting. So Flynn passes out, and Miles finds him, and then after a bit of conversation, Miles, who really, really, really wants to confess to what he believes is a priest, shows him this secret passageway. I mean, right the way through the movie, we're constantly getting Miles wanting to confess his sins.
Yeah.
I mean, how did that make you feel? Because it made me feel a bit uncomfortable.
Yes, I thought he'd done some really bad things because of what you learn about the hotel itself and the nature of the guests and just the nature of the setup there. You don't know what you're going to find in some of these back rooms or the sort of corridor. When I think that was quite good because you are expecting him to be potentially the worst of them all. And actually, he's not. He is just probably
the best
PTSD-ridden veteran.
Yeah.
Who's had to do some not very nice things and seen some very not very nice things in his line of work once he's come back from the war. It's just like a Bruce Springsteen song. So I thought he was going to be a lot worse than he was. And that's one good thing about this film. It's not predictable. You can't you can't charge it with being predictable because it's not.
No, it's absolutely not. And I think a lot of the things you expect to happen don't happen.
Yeah. Or things that you don't expect to happen do.
Yeah. So Miles shows Father Flynn the secret passageway, basically explains that management, in inverted commas, whoever they are, having filmed like specific guests' sexy times and send them the footage. Miles says he's held one of these back because that particular dead public figure had been really kind to him, aka JFK. So when Flynn goes off to find the film, Miles then sees the confrontation between John Hamm's character, Emily, and Rose. So John Hamm's come to the door and he's been like, "Hey, ma'am, the bellhops asked me to make sure everyone's all right because there's a storm and stuff," and she doesn't want to let him in, so he kicks the door down, punches her in the face,
yep,
unties Rose, and then Emily stands up and basically blows him in half with a shotgun. Meanwhile, Miles is behind the mirror and gets a load of like shotgun buck in his face.
So the way they do it is that you don't know who you see the confrontation with Laramie / Dwight and Emily and Rose before they've gone behind. Is that right? Because they hear all coughing and spluttering.
Yeah, it's quite a while. Like,
oh God, what the fuck is behind there? And it's after that happens that you see Father Flynn and Miles go behind there. So a lot of it is the way they constructed it was quite effective in that respect. So you are thinking, shit, what's behind there?
I think it's a good like 20 minutes before we find out that it's Miles, if not longer.
Yeah.
Which I think is really, really clever. You're right, like it that gives you suspense and it gives you that kind of guessing game. It could be anyone at this point.
Yeah.
You know, we don't know who's hanging around there.
Mm.
Ugh. Mm. La, 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 la. At the same time as this is happening, and this is not chronological to the plot, but it's chronological, well, not chronological to the film, but chronological to the actual plot, if it was in order. Darlene has seen all of this happen.
Why was she outside? Because of just trying to get away from the priest?
Yeah, I think so. She'd been shocked, and I think she was like, I'm just going to leave now. This is awful. So she tries to get away in her car, but it won't start because Laramie / Dwight has basically pulled out some wires of everyone's car so they can't leave. And then Father Flynn arrives and tells her his story. So he basically explains that he's actually Doc O'Kelly. He's been in prison for 10 years for a robbery, recently paroled. He came here to get the money back that his brother hid in those first scenes back in 1959. But he's got dementia. He got the wrong room. He wanted to get into her room without hurting her, to dig up the floor and see if he could get the money. And I think this whole encounter between them is really interesting because Darlene is, you know, we said this earlier, she's very composed outwardly, but inwardly you can see her mind going.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about the conversation is that Father Flynn is basically saying, I know you're thinking this, that and the other, but you could do this and you could do that. And I thought that watching him say it and her think it was very, very interesting. Like, she's such an expressive actress.
Yeah, she definitely is. And yeah, you can see her mind working. Even when they were chatting in the bar bit, you can see she's sort of sizing him up and seeing what her situation is with him. And when he's explaining the situation in the car and her options, you can see it in her face, her deciding what to do.
What would you have done?
I probably would have been like, you can have the fucking keys, I want to leave. Help me get my car started, you can have the keys, I don't want your money. I mean, I'm not speaking as a black woman in 1960s America, but if it was me, yeah, I'd be like, I want to get out of here, so you can have the money, I don't care.
Yeah, I'd probably want half the money.
I want in on this plan, on this plot.
Yeah, I want in on this, like...
There's absolutely no guarantee this criminal that tried to drug you is going to give you half the money. Quit while you're ahead, I reckon.
No.
Get out with your life.
That's very true. However, what I've got to say is the way that they dig up the floor is genius.
Yeah.
So Darlene agrees that she will split the money with him. He can come in and dig up the floor, that's fine. So and we watch this like largely from the perspective of Emily, because she's now been through the mirror, found Miles, blah blah blah, and she's watching through the mirror as Darlene is singing, wandering around the room, and every time that Father Flynn has to like hammer into the floorboard to yank it up, she claps and she is belting out some absolutely beautiful vocals. And I just thought it was a really clever bit of staging.
Do you think the way she's looking into the mirror, it's like she knows there is someone there,
Do you think she knows, or she's expecting someone to be there, and if so, who?
I think she might be suspicious that someone is there, but I don't know if she knows who, because I'm assuming that Flynn told, from what I remember, told her about the...
Yeah, but then who would tunnel? She be thinking was there? But or maybe she's just looking into
fucking
it.
Anyone
like,
at this point.
Yeah. If anyone's out there, I can see you. Well, I can't see you, but I've got an idea that you're there.
Ugh. I mean, it's creepy, isn't it? The idea that someone's behind a wall looking at you.
Yeah.
Like, really creepy.
For both people concerned.
Yeah. And watching from both sides of it as well was really interesting. Really interesting. So after this happened, they've got the money and they are off to go. And then all of a sudden, Billy Lee arrives.
Bing, bing, bing.
And he basically takes everyone hostage. So we've had a bit of kind of playing around with Emily and Rose and Miles trying to work out whether to beat him up or not. And then it sort of comes out that Rose has called Billy Lee to come and get her because she's full on in the cult.
Yeah.
So everyone's taken hostage. This is pretty rough. We get a lot of stuff happening here. But I think the boldest thing is a game of like, do you want to die roulette?
Red or black? Do you want to die? Red is life, black is death.
But also, who knew whether if your number came up, you were getting, your colour came up, you were getting shot or not?
Yeah, you don't actually know what you're betting on.
No, you're just picking a colour. So he says to Emily, pick a colour, red or black. She won't, she has to, she picks. And then the game is between her and Miles. He spins the roulette wheel. It lands on whatever colour it lands on. And he shoots Emily dead.
That was what I was like.
Brutal.
Oh, did not expect that to happen. Really didn't expect that to happen.
No.
I thought Miles was a goner.
Poor Miles. I mean, he does go.
But I thought he was a goner right
which
then.
Is sad.
I also thought that would spur Rose into being kind of deprogrammed. Again, not predictable, because it did not work like that whatsoever.
I think she's a complete and utter nutjob.
Yeah, she's well in there.
Yeah, she is. There's no going back for Rose, unfortunately. So then Billy Lee wants to play another game of live or die roulette with Darlene and Father Flynn, because he's been questioning them. He wants to know about the money, he wants to know who he really is and all of this stuff. And there's this really sad moment in there where when Miles realizes that he's not a priest.
That's a
and
sad
I don't know
moment,
why, but it really got me.
But it's also sad when he's like, he asks him his real name and he's like really struggling, and then he says to Darlene,
he can't remember,
did I ever tell you my real name? Because he can't remember. That's quite, I thought that was quite poignant as well.
Yeah, it was. Sad. Mm. Just really sad. And then shit, you know, all hell lets loose. So Flynn, Father Flynn, basically stands up and headbutts Billy in the head, like, and pushes him back. There's a big fight that happens. And Darlene at this point is like, Miles, you have to help us. There's a gun in between them. She's got her hands tied at her back. She can't do anything. And this is where we get Miles' backstory, where we realise that, you know, she says to him, how many people have you killed? And he says 123, and you think,
shit.
Murder hotel.
Yeah, they're all buried in the basement.
Yeah, like, that's what the tunnels are for, but it's so tragic because that's not the case. He was a sniper in Vietnam, and he's so young, and it's so, I mean, you know, so common, obviously, that, you know, and we get this flashback, and then he basically saves everyone by shooting everyone in the head, which is amazing. Like, I was really almost proud of him.
It was a little bit jarring, though. I found like he went into full action hero mode and like kicked the gun into his hand, and then he was like cocked it and just shooting everyone. I was like, this is a bit cheesy. Like, it belonged in a different film.
I mean,
in my
yeah.
mind it was something
I just
satisfying.
I think by that point I was so into the last bit.
Yeah, but it was a bit like, oh okay, this is a bit silly in my opinion.
So then Rose jumps on to Billy Lee and she's absolutely distraught. Miles tries to comfort her and she guts him. She actually guts him.
I mean, Miles, you were in the army. Have you had no training? The fuck are you doing? This is a hostile. Why are you going to comfort her?
He's having a hard time.
I know she's a little girl, but we've established that she's mad. Her bloke's just shot her sister and she don't even care. Have some sense.
Yeah, good
man.
Point.
You're a former soldier.
Very, very good point.
You were a sniper. You killed 123 people and you're getting undone by a little girl. Hate to see it.
Shame. Mm. But don't worry. The priest shoots her in the head.
Phew.
Thank God. Thank God for Father Flynn. And then, basically, Father Flynn takes on the moment of like last confession and absolves him of his sins as he's dying.
That was nice,
which I thought was really good.
Yes, that was good. It was like, He really wanted that.
Yeah, he needed it. Help him, you know, was what Darlene was saying. So then Darlene and Father Flynn, because I'm not going to call him Doc, wander out with all the money together after throwing the film into the fire. And later we see Darlene performing at, I think, the Humdinger Lounge?
In Reno.
In Reno. And Father Flynn's there watching her, and that's how the film ends.
Happy ending for all involved, apart from everyone that died. At least JFK's memory was enshrined. We didn't find out who was fucking... Well, I mean, the more you find out about him, the more it gets sullied. But yeah, not by a film.
No, there's no need for that to happen.
No.
I have mixed feelings about the ending, because I think of all of them, maybe... I think Darlene was probably the most deserving to get out of this in one piece, but I don't know how I feel about Father Flynn.
Yeah,
but it was such a massacre.
He left Miles to begin with when he got shot, like with the buck in his face. He just fucking left him. So yeah, I think that's what another thing is a bit uneven. Like, he's a bit of a prick, and I'm fine with that. Like, you can have a main character that's not that sympathetic, but then they kind of try to make him a bit more sympathetic at the end. And the fact that he like went to see her perform, again, a little bit cheesy from a different film. That's what I mean. The tone,
I think
the
he's in
tone
love with her.
Was a bit uneven for me. She has a beautiful voice, though, so I don't blame him for wanting to go to see her sing.
And she sang every single one of those live on camera.
Really?
And actually, so that scene where they're digging... Yeah, that scene where he's pulling out the floorboards, she sang that series of songs something like 27 times.
What a treat.
Through all of the different scenes and shots, which is amazing.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So none of them were pre-recorded. It was all her singing on screen, which was fantastic. Mm. Lucy.
Yes.
What's your favourite scene from this film?
Okay, my favourite scene, other than any of the scenes where Hemsworth's got his shirt off, is probably actually when Laramie goes behind the corridor. I thought it was so unnerving, and I thought the way it was shot was really... You didn't know what was going to come. You know what you were going to see, didn't know what was going to happen, and I thought it was really masterful the way it was done. And I think I would have preferred to have a bit more of that character trying to investigate things than it just going south so quickly, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I think that was a really excellent scene.
Very good choice, Lucy. We did. We lost our intrepid investigator, didn't we? Early doors.
Damn it.
My favourite scene is not quite so cultured as yours, so it's 100% got to be when Chris Hemsworth is wiggling his way across the room to Deep Purple's Hush.
I tried to take this question seriously, but, you know, yeah. He is snake hip.
But it was like, but for so many reasons. One, because it was like half shirtless Chris Hemsworth snake hipping his way across the room. Two, the music. I love Deep Purple. It's a brilliant song.
Yeah, it's a good song. It's good use of music.
And actually, like, you've got that whole jukebox thing the whole way through with Darlene and Father Flynn and everything. But also, for me, it just highlighted the absolute insanity of the character. And I just thought it was really clever.
It was a good moment. It was funny. Like, he wasn't fully committed to it, I didn't think. So it was, like, borderline awkward. You could
it was
see
a bit awkward,
his, in his face.
It
wasn't quite, like, he hadn't quite given himself to the moment. But it was a good moment. It was a good section.
It made me giggle.
Yes.
It did make me giggle. Well, that kind of brings us pretty much to the end, I think. I think that there's one more question I want to ask you, Lucy. And, you know, a lot of people who've reviewed this and written about this film have talked about the idea that the El Royale is purgatory or limbo.
Interesting.
What do you
I haven't
think?
Seen that. I think religion does loom large over the film. Particularly you see with the flashbacks with Billy Lee talking about, you know, getting the girls to do the tussle for good and bad. And it's like you're so busy playing the game that it's taken your mind off everything else. And yeah, you know, Miles wanting absolution for his sins. I think, yeah, I mean, it, on the surface, yes, that it would make sense. But I also don't think it's actually as deep as all of that. Because why is Darlene there? What's she done? That's bad. Nothing. She should be in heaven with
nothing,
that voice.
Absolutely
sings
nothing.
Like an angel.
Absolutely. Yeah, it didn't occur to me until I'd read it, but I thought it was important to bring up because a lot of people have raised it as a, you know, a potential. And I think the idea of people turning up at a motel in the arse end of nowhere across two state lines is, you know, it's a bit lost and hellish, isn't it? Yeah, a little bit. But I felt that was too complex for something that was actually quite a fun and interesting film in its own way.
Yeah, I don't think it needs that extra.
Which is not going to sound fun.
Yeah.
No. I think it overcomplicates it when it doesn't need to be. Mm. Before we go, I've got a couple of bits of trivia for you, Lucy. So there were two people who were originally cast for the, or considered for the roles of Billy Lee and Darlene Sweet that weren't eventually cast, which I think is really interesting. So Beyoncé was considered for Darlene.
Really?
Yeah, which is, I wouldn't have liked that.
She's not a great actress. Like, not bad, but she's nowhere near as good as Cynthia Erivo.
No, and she was great in Austin Powers, but not for this. No. The other one, which I think is very interesting, and I can, and knowing this afterwards in hindsight, I can see what was trying to be emulated here, is that Matthew McConaughey was originally considered for Billy Lee.
Hmm. All right, all right, all right.
I can see that.
Definitely. Maybe he's a touch old.
Yeah, I think that's probably it, isn't
it? Yeah, I mean, he's got shirtless cult leader written all over him, hasn't he, a lot of the time.
100%. I'd join his cult.
I'd join Chris Hemsworth's cult.
Yeah, can I join both?
Sign me up now.
And speaking of cults, so this is, I mean, it's a bit grim, but I thought it was interesting. So when they originally officially introduced Billy Lee into the story, the song that's playing is 12:30, Young Girls Are Coming to the Canyon by the Mamas and the Papas. And allegedly, when they found the bodies of Sharon Tate and her friends, the song was her that song was her playing in another room.
Creepy.
Fucking creepy, isn't it?
Cults are actually bad. I'm not going to join a cult, don't worry.
No, I'm not going to join a cult. I don't want to join a Manson cult. I just want to go and live freely with Matthew McConaughey and Chris Hemsworth.
I would sign up for that. I don't want to have to do any wrestling.
Wilderness. No, no wrestling. We won't make you. I mean, that's it for Bad Times at the El Royale.
Stupid name.
I think it's been quite a good time. Yeah, it is a stupid name. We, but the acronym doesn't work. Batata. Batata. But I think we've had a good time talking about
the
El Royale.
It's worth watching, for sure, I would say, if you've got the time.
Definitely.
But yeah, I think it was a missed opportunity in many ways, but it's interesting, an interesting film with a great cast and soundtrack.
Yep, absolutely. Definitely worth giving a watch. I believe it's on Sky Cinema and wherever else you might get your movies. I think it's enjoyable. Let us know what you think. You can get in touch by email on fancriticalpodcast@gmail.com or any of our social media channels as usual, and we'll be back in the coming weeks with some new content across all of the different areas of our channel. But thank you, Lucy, for taking some time out of your mothering duties to come and talk movies with me.
Absolutely fine, love to do it. Thank you for hosting.
I was about to thank myself then, really awkwardly. Thank you, me. Thank you for thanking me, Lucy. And thank you guys all for listening. It's been a great laugh. And we'll look forward to speaking to you all soon. Bye.
I need love to ease my mind. I need to find someone to call mine. But mama said... You can't hurry love, no, you just have to wait. She said love don't come easy, it's a game of give and take. You can't hurry love, no, you just have to wait. She said trust, give it time, no matter how long it takes. Now how many heartaches must I stand before I find a love to let me live again? Right now the only thing that keeps me hanging on, when I feel my strength, yeah, it's almost gone. I remember mama said, cause my heart to break. Now I can't bear to live my life alone. I grow impatient for a love to call my own. And when I feel that I She said love don't come easy. It's a game of give and take. You can't hurry love. No, you just have to wait. You gotta trust, give it time. No matter how long it takes, I said wait. Now love, love don't come easy. But I keep on waiting, anticipating for that soft voice to talk to me at night, for some tender arms to hold me tight. I keep waiting, keep on waiting, but it ain't easy, it ain't easy. But mama said you can't hurry love, no, you just have to wait. She said love don't come easy, it's a game of give and take. You can't hurry love, no, you just have to wait. You gotta trust, give it time, no matter how long.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.